Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Republican National Committee co-chairman Bob Poduchik, in an editorial for Cleveland.com last week, blamed Governor Kasich for costing Troy Balderson votes in the 12th Congressional District special election against Democrat Danny O'Connor. Top political strategist for Governor Kasich responded with the accusation that the RNC is trying to rig the 2020 presidential nomination process. And so it goes in the world of politics. Luckily, it's time for our weekly reporter roundtable. They will save us. Joining us is Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. What an intro.
Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Good morning.
And Cincinnati Inquirer State Government reporter Jesse Balmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
I know. You guys, no pressure. But Bob Poduchik wrote that John Kasich lost Troy Balderson votes because of his endorsement. Is this crazy town or what? I mean, I know it's the crazy season, but...
Isn't that odd?
I think it's really odd.
Yeah.
I mean, but on the other hand, this is something we could have predicted years ago, and I'm sure we did, that, you know, parties start eating their own. They cannibalize each other
right.
when there's so much power vested in one side of the aisle.
Well, you remember, you know, when Troy Balderson first started his campaign, he had that ad about how he was going to back President Trump and all of his policies and he, you know, trying to be Trumpy. And then he kind of didn't have those ads and he kind of backed away from it. And I remember when I moderated a debate with the 12th congressional candidates and he was very emphatic that he does not support President Trump's integration policy as far as separating women, you know, moms and children.
Parents from children.
So,
right.
Yeah. So then, you know, he kind of backed away a little bit. And then that's when, you know, a couple weeks before, Kasich comes in and gives his endorsement. And Kasich is thought to be more moderate than Trump and maybe try to go after those moderate voters. And then, you know, the weekend before, here you've got Trump coming in, President Trump's coming in, and he's trying to shore up. And you know, it was kind of a mixed message, didn't you think, from the Balderson, you know, where was he? Was he with Trump or was he with Kasich?
One of you just wrote about that, right? Is Balderson? Oh, no, that was whether it was Mike DeWine was a Trump or a Kasich Republican. But I suppose the question could be asked of any candidate.
Yeah, it's a similar situation.
Problem.
They're trying to toe this line because President Trump remains extremely popular among Republican voters in Ohio, among the base. And so you can't abandon those voters. But at the same time, you need to capture the more moderate, your more John Kasich Republicans in Ohio, maybe, if you want to call them that.
I never would have.
Right.
And also independent voters. You know, when you look at like the 12th district makeup, you had, you know, about a third from Franklin County, about a third from Delaware County and a third from elsewhere. So, you had all three of those groups represented within that district that you needed to reach out to. So that was the position that Balderson was in. And, you know, leading up to the special election, you saw a lot of political observers even ahead of that saying, you know, he owes this win to maybe Kasich even for coming in toward the end. It was kind of a, 11th hour endorsement just days before. But you know, maybe that endorsement and that support kind of eased the mind of that John Kasich Republican or independently minded voter who doesn't want to fully support Donald Trump and doesn't support all of his policies that, hey, you know, Balderson is not a 100% always with President Trump candidate, that he is maybe more independently minded, that he'll, you know, make decisions based on what he thinks is best for the district.
Hmm.
Yeah, John Kasich and Donald Trump have been going back and forth since 2015 when they were both presidential candidates on the Republican side, mm-hmm. and it really hasn't stopped.
It seemed it abated for a little while.
A little bit? Yeah, last week it definitely fired back up as we all were trying to take credit for really eking out a race in the 12th district.
To come this close, and by the way, they haven't finished counting all the votes yet.
Right.
The provisional and the absentees are, again, there's about 3,000 in play now, and mm-hmm. It's about 1,500 votes separate the apparent winner, Troy Balderson, from Democrat Danny O'Connor. Later this week, the vote should be in. I mean, they should be counted by the end of this week, right?
The deadline is Friday.
Okay, the deadline. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, it's trying to figure out what kind of Republican you are. It makes me wonder if they're having issues like this in other states, like, say, Jeff Flake state or something like that. Are you a Flake Republican or are you a Trump Republican?
Well, the polling has showed that Republican women in particular, they're in trouble with Republican women with Trump because he's alienated some Republican women. And that, you know, when you're talking margins, not having Republican women matters. So
especially in a place like Delaware County, which I have said I think it was what brought the edge in, although I don't know if there's anything out there to validate my supposition.
No, it pretty much came down to Delaware County.
You look at like turnout, you know, that's one indicator that people were looking at after the election is, you know, if you're trying to decide if Trump or Kasich should get the credit or blame, is where did the turnout really come from? And turnout in your areas that went stronger for Trump in 2016 was lower than percentage wise than in like Delaware County, Franklin County, where Trump support was much lower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was kind of shocked that the city of Powell actually went for Danny O'Connor, mm-hmm. and that would have normally been a very red area in most elections. So, mm-hmm.
And Worthington's gone Democratic in recent election cycles, but I think it was something like 75% or 78% mm-hmm. for.
That's a lot.
Danny O'Connor.
Yeah, there was a reason why Danny O'Connor supporters and Democrats were knocking on every door in Worthington and Clintonville. Mm-hmm. Those were the areas that they had really targeted, and it showed in the numbers. So,
statistically, Danny O'Connor is not expected to emerge the victor even after these 3,000 votes are counted, but he could get a lot closer. And what would trigger an automatic recount in that case?
It's 0.5%. Okay, so if it gets that close, that's something that the state would and the counties would, you know, foot the bill for the recount. Mm-hmm. If it's a little bit higher than that, the parties, the candidates could themselves, Danny O'Connor could. It seems kind of unlikely to me that he would do that, given that we're going to just do this all again in November. It's mm-hmm. almost like we get another shot at this race. So
in a much different set of circumstances, right. a regular midterm election.
Yeah, right. More names on the ballot.
More turnout then.
Higher turnout. Students are back. And students, Ohio State, kind of the northeast campus part of Ohio State, is actually part of the 12th district. So that's a kind of X factor.
So we'll know by the end of the week. Well, we won't know. The deadline will be by the end of the week.
That's when we should get the final count, by the end of the week.
Okay.
So.
As far as John Kasich goes, since he's worried about whether or not the 2020 presidential nomination process is going to be rigged or not, does that yet another shot at flag, you know, is that a flag for you? Or do you already think that he's planning on running and you're shaking your head sardonically?
I find it kind of funny because, you know, he hasn't officially announced he's running, but I don't know, his actions have said, hey, I'm running and I'm in it big time. And that's, you just cited one more example mm-hmm. where he's talking about the being rigged. Kind of reminds me of our president who, before the election in 2016, talked about the election being rigged. Mm. So, you know, I don't know. It's like you kind of set it up there so that if you don't make it, then you can, I don't know.
Well, and also a national party supporting the president running for re-election will
How
clutch my hurt
I
pearls.
Know.
This is shocking.
Right. Exactly. I mean, as far as Republicans are concerned, they aren't going to have a primary because they got the guy in the office, right? The incumbent.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think if Democrats in the middle of President Obama's reelection bid were like, oh, it's rigged that some other name isn't getting as much support as the incumbent president, you know, that would be very odd. And so that's kind of the same argument that John Kasich was making right now.
But even if you look just at Ohio recent polling and Trump approval versus Kasich approval among Republicans who would be voting in a Republican primary, Trump has a higher approval rate. So it's not like, yes, across the board, his approval ratings, the president's approval ratings are not good. But among his base, which are the people who would be voting in a primary,
right.
they are still very high.
Yeah. Danny, now back to the 12th congressional special election. Danny O'Connor still has not ceded. He has not, given up. Is there any tactical purpose for that? I mean, he just to see how close he gets.
Right. Right. Okay. His fundraising people have been sending out, and I'm not really sure I understand what they're doing, but they're sending out a thing, emails saying, hey, give us money so we can do a recount and give us money for this or that. They're very aggressively still fundraising for him in this race, not in November as much as this race. So it's kind of, that's kind of odd. But, he hasn't given up. And if you look at the way that, he's talking to his supporters, it's just like, hey, let's keep out there. Let's keep going. Let's keep doing.
He's still running for another election, right. The same election, same seat, same, so all those efforts that his campaign did over the summer, all the door knocking that we just mentioned and other things. I mean, now is just a continuation of that. And that kind of built the foundation for both campaigns, all that campaigning in the summer for the rematch in November, if you will. But I mean, there's really nothing to lose for him by not,
ceding
the race. Yeah. And it's still possible that he could make up that gap statistically. It's not, the probability is not great, not good, but there's still some chance. So, to say, I don't know. It's like there's nothing to lose but for him to just stay.
Daryl Rowland of the Dispatch wrote, though, he said, O'Connor now faces the prospect of losing on election night, losing again when the official count is released this week, and likely losing a third time since recounts in the electric voting era seldom significantly move official results. So he kind of put a negative spin on this lose-lose-lose thing. But again, it's so unusual to be facing off again in a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know that I live in the 12th district, and I don't know that just hearing like my neighbors and stuff talk about this election, I think everyone pretty much understood that this was like a weird animal, right? And it's in the middle of August. People are taking their last vacations before school starts. The understanding is, yes, that there is one in November as well. And so I don't know that it's a win or a loss is like that big of a deal going into the election, especially when you have such a mix of other races on the ballot. You're going to have the statewide office holders. You're going to have local representatives and senators, judges. Hopefully people will get that far down on their ballot. A statewide issue. So I don't know. I don't know that saying he lost three times, I mean, that makes a good talking point and maybe a good point for political ads, but I don't know that it will carry much water.
And I know horseshoes, close is not supposed to count, but but the thing is that in this race, close does count because it was watched because it's a telling race for what can happen in November. And honestly, Danny O'Connor shouldn't have been even able to come close in this race because of the makeup of that district.
Drawn. The district was drawn to favor Republicans.
Right. So if
you've got... Andrew Balderson, by the way, is a relatively moderate Republican. So...
Yeah, this special election was odd for so many reasons. It was simultaneously very important because it was the last one before the November election. So it was a nationally watched race. Everyone was looking for signs of enthusiasm, especially after Ohio's primaries were not super enthusiastic.
Yeah, right.
And so it was super important from that perspective. But at the end of the day, after we're done counting these votes, if we have to go through a recount, whoever is ultimately elected, who it seems like it will be the Republican Troy Balderson, will maybe take a couple votes and then that's the end of his term. So it was a very short amount of time to get very worked up about.
We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cleveland.com State House reporter Jackie Borchardt, Ohio Public Radio State House News reporter Joe Ingles, and Cincinnati Inquirer State Government reporter Jesse Ballmert. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about the Mike DeWine as a Trump or a Kasich Republican? Jesse Ballmer, you wrote about that. Did you come to any conclusion?
Well, I came to the conclusion that this is a bit of a landmine he has to kind of dance through. Because on one side, as we've already discussed, Trump is exceedingly popular with Republicans, and that those are votes that Mike DeWine wants to shore up and make sure are in his camp and are turning out, even though Republicans typically do. Mm-hmm. And then John Kasich is popular among those independents and even Democratic voters who might be in the middle, and that might be who Rich Cordray and Mike DeWine are fighting over. And so one example where this kind of played out was on Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion is part of Obamacare. Mike DeWine previously, you know, shortly after taking office as Attorney General, sued over Obamacare. And obviously Trump has campaigned on getting rid of it, getting rid of the individual mandate, et cetera, and everything that goes with it. Obviously, John Kasich has made part of his legacy the expansion of Medicaid. And so Mike DeWine had to go in between those two folks and say, okay, I'm going to keep Medicaid expansion after kind of disparaging Medicaid expansion earlier, and I'm going to keep it, but I'm going to put some, you know, work requirements on some of it for those who are able to work. And so it's a position where both sides have strong opinions on this particular policy, and he has to kind of find some way to appease both Trump Republicans and Kasich Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, walk the line. You know, I think that's the thing. It's like the Republicans really are in between a rock and a hard place, the ones running statewide, because you really need to appeal to all to win.
I was wondering, I mean, I know that the Democrats put this out there, but I think it's a kind of an interesting question is at whose side will Mike DeWine sit come state Republican dinner time when the president shows up, President Trump or Governor Kasich?
I haven't confirmed, but I'm not sure if John Kasich is going to be there.
Yeah, that was my first thought.
The same thing. We heard that he was maybe throwing his own dinner. I mean, my gosh, what are the odds of that? Well, he didn't show up to his own party's national convention and now his own state's.
Well, we don't know for sure, but yeah, I haven't had an answer to that question either.
What do you think?
Also, I don't know that President Trump will sit and eat dinner. I don't know. Usually at these things,
They just show up, blah, 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 and leave.
Speaker kind of breezes in and gives their speech and leaves.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, this is a weird political world. This is John Kasich's last year as governor.
He's been a lame duck for longer than a year.
It's true. But in theory, you would expect the Republicans to be hosting some sort of brouhaha. Let's celebrate the successes of a two-term fairly popular governor. And yet the day is going to be largely about Donald Trump. And that just speaks to politics in Ohio right now, which are kind of all over the place.
Well, and the Ohio Republican Party is aligned with Trump more than they are with Kasich. I mean, you know, when Kasich came in the office, you know, his team took over the state party. His guy, Matt Borges, was put as the chairman. And, you know, Matt was not a full-throated supporter of Donald Trump in 2016. And he lost his job. He lost his job, you know. And you know, Trump wanted someone else in that position. And so now we have Jane Timken. So it's now, you know, Ohio Republican Party, but it's fully aligned with the president's goals. And look at, you know, we started off this segment talking about this op-ed on Cleveland.com from Bob Buducek, and he was the state Trump's campaign guy in Ohio. Now he's the co-chairman of the national RNC, Republican National Committee. So, you know, all the way up and down the line, I mean, they're Ohio folks, they're Ohio people, but they've been chosen by Trump to lead the party.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard Jackie Borchardt, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Also with us is Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau and Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to talk about the state auditor's analysis of the prescription drug middlemen. They made a lot of money from even just generic prescriptions, Jackie Borchardt. And tell us what, you know, what it looks like the state auditor is planning to do.
Well, the state auditor was asked to look at what kind of I don't want to call them profits, but money that that these pharmacy benefit managers or middlemen were keeping compared to the what they were paying pharmacies for various prescription drugs. And these are all through Medicaid, which in Ohio, almost all of Ohio's Medicaid participants are enrolled in managed care plans. So they operate kind of like private insurance plans. And there's five entities in Ohio that provide these. And there are two pharmacy benefit managers that they have contracts, they're vendors of these managed care plans. So it's public taxpayer dollars that go to the managed care plans, and the managed care plans then contract with these pharmacy benefit managers. And there's two of them that operate in Ohio, and the larger one is CVS Caremark, which their parent company also operates CVS pharmacies across the state. So Auditor Yost was asked to look a little bit deeper. There had been a third-party analysis done a couple months ago at the request of the Department of Medicaid that found about $225 million is what the difference is between what these pharmacy middlemen are paid for the drugs versus what they pay the pharmacy. So it's kind of what they keep.
And not what? Bad.
Well, that report also found that by these companies negotiating drug prices, they were saving about $145 million a year. These were touted as a way to save money because they were negotiating drug prices on a larger scale and able to do work that the managed care plans didn't have the specialty to do. So Yost dug a little bit deeper than that and found that out of that $225 million, most of it was actually made off generics, which is shocking, I think, to most people who think that generic drugs should be cheaper, right? And that by going the generic route, we're saving money, when this shows that with those generic drugs, they were, you know, keeping about 31% of the money that they were getting to spend on the drugs. They were actually pocketing. Now, of course, this report actually leaves a lot of unanswered questions. This is one piece of the drug pricing puzzle. It doesn't mean that, you know, these companies are making $225 million in profits. They could be losing money in other areas of operating. We don't know, for example, why the money that they've kept, also known as the price spread, is higher in some areas of the state than in others. Northwest Ohio in particular, for some reason, the price that they were paying pharmacies was much lower than in other parts of the state for the same drug, which, again, logically, you think, why is that? Why is that? Especially since all of these enrollees are all receiving Medicaid. They're all in the same program, essentially. So anyway, the auditor presented this report last week to the Joint Medicaid Oversight Committee, which is Republicans, Democrats, House members, Senate members. And basically, they want more information. And they think that this is definitely something that Ohio needs to act on. Last week, ahead of Yost's report, the Department of Medicaid announced that they were asking all the managed care providers to cancel their contracts with CVS Caremark and Optimum Rx, which is the other one, and to enter into new contracts for what's called a pass-through pricing model, which instead of allowing these spreads per drug, and it's kind of a gray area, they would pay instead like an administrative fee, and then the actual price of the drug would transfer through. And I've read that there's some pros and cons to both of these kinds of things. And what the auditor said last week is he doesn't think that that's a good idea to just abruptly change course without examining that option and seeing whether that's really the right way that Ohio should go, or if there's other things that Ohio should do. You know, he called it the black box. Right now, the black mm-hmm. box is on the price spread, and we don't know, you know, why.
The basis for it.
Right, right. And with this new one, it's just another black box, right? The administrative fee. Well, what is
What's
the
that
fee
based on?
And, yeah, what is that based on? And how much is it? And where does that money go? So he cautioned against jumping to that right away. I don't know. Dave Burke, he's a senator from Marysville, and he's the chairman of that committee. And when he was reporters were asking him what he thought of this report and all sorts of questions about, you know, what's next afterward, he said, "I don't know," at least a dozen times. It's such a with a lot of things. And this is an example that he used. With a lot of things with our taxpayer dollars, you want to find out how much it costs. It's very easy to find out. You want to know how much it costs for a truckload of gravel, or, you know, to pave potholes, or, you know, asphalt. You can find out what that costs, and you can compare it to other companies and find a lower cost. And you can't do that with healthcare and with these, you know, with this prescription drug, you know, system that we've built up with Medicaid.
It's going on in other states too, right?
Yeah, yeah. So West Virginia, I believe, just changed it. They also scrapped their pharmacy benefit managers. I think they're also preparing a similar analysis. But Ohio is really like the first or among the first states to look at drug pricing through pharmacy benefit managers in this way. And this topic is something that has gained steam in just the last couple of years as something that needs more scrutiny when you're talking in the larger conversation about drug pricing and drug cost. And so this is one of the maybe few areas where Ohio is kind of ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. Senator Burke said that he feels like action on this item is kind of running in tandem with the problem. It's not like we're chasing it, which is, again, in Medicaid and in really anything, that's kind of an area where to say Ohio is a leader is rare. But yeah. but that's why it's kind of important. I think Senator Burke said it's important for them to get it right, and that he said it's probably not going to be just a single bill fix. It's something that they're going to look at very carefully over the coming months. If something needs attention right away, they're willing to you know, do that through legislation or administratively. And he's eyeing really next year's budget bill as maybe the place and the time to do a heavier lift on how the state works with these drugs. Because, you know, the pharmacy benefit managers are getting a lot of the brunt of this. But what it really comes down to is we pay, or the state pays, these managed care plans to, you know, figure out the best use of our taxpayer dollars to find efficiencies and
the private sector care is going to do a better job than the public sector, right?
That's one opinion of things. And that it was probably one of the most interesting points that the auditor raised last week is, you know, maybe this is a warning sign that when you talk about privatizing pieces of government, that you need to be careful about that. And that, you know, for example, we never talk about privatizing our police force. You know, some things just maybe shouldn't be privatized. And if you are, then we need to be careful about how that happens.
The pharmacy benefit managers, when they ordered the state to cease the relationship with them, what then? I mean, who's doing the work of the PBMs then?
Well, it basically said, we don't want to do the spread pricing model anymore. We want you to do the pass-through model.
Okay, so we still have them as long as you're willing to do the administrative type of
right. So thing. Conceivably, gotcha. They would probably, I don't know, I haven't talked to the care plans, but my guess is they're probably negotiating contracts with the same players that were doing it before, just with a different pricing model. But some people have argued that it's not necessarily more transparent because you have these administrative fees mm-hmm. that are kind of, you know.
What are those based on?
Exactly. What are you getting for that?
Okay, well, okay, so we're going to continue our conversation. We'll take a quick break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Jackie Borchardt, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News reporter Joe Ingles, Cincinnati Enquirer State Government reporter Jesse Ballmert. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. So the electronic classroom of tomorrow has lost another battle in court. This is time with an appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court. They wouldn't even take it up, I guess, and then they had shot him down on another issue, which was significant as well. Is ECOT done? Is it toast?
It
Joe Ingles?
Sure appears so, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, what we've got right now is the Supreme Court is saying basically, you know, they ruled on the issue of the big issue first, and they and basically the takeaway on that was that the state could go ahead and go back to Bill Lauger, who was the founder of ECOT, and try to get the money that was owed to them then. But then last week, the ruling was more of a procedural thing, and again, the Supreme Court, you know, kicked that back in the favor of the state. So mm-hmm. right now, you know, ECOT has been a lot of it has been liquidated. There certainly they don't have the online schools. And the question is now, where do you go to get all the millions of dollars that the state says are owed to it for, you know, paying out too much money for
overcounting.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
What do you think the state has learned from all of this ECOT shenanigans?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question, what they've learned. I mean, I think ECOT is going to be one of those issues that this fall we're going to see a lot of the Democrats talking ECOT, ECOT, ECOT. I'm already seeing that.
And that's because Republicans?
Because a lot of the Republicans got money from ECOT, and they supported ECOT through this. Some of the Democrats did, too. But they, I know in that 12th district race, ECOT has come up, and definitely in the House race up there, State Rep Andy Brenner is the head of the Education Committee, mm-hmm. and he's been very outspoken in support of charter schools mm-hmm. and at one time ECOT. And I know his Democratic opponent, Louise Valentine, has already been talking about ECOT and how Representative Brenner has failed the constituents of that district by embracing that and short shifting, as she would, you know, kind of say, of the public schools up there. So it's already becoming an issue in that race, and I can see it becoming an issue statewide just because, you know, a lot of people had a lot of questions about it. There wasn't as much oversight as there is with a traditional public school mm-hmm. considered.
Which
know.
Is kind of the idea of charter schools.
Yeah.
But the fact is that they're spending public money, and
that's right.
Taxpayers want to know how their money's being spent.
Right.
You know,
yeah, I would say ideally what they would learn is, you know, better regulation, better tracking of hours, especially on online schools where it is harder than, okay, this butt is in this seat for this period of time. And I think that was where ECOT had several challenges. And then also there is a bit of a challenge when you incorporate so much of the charter school population into one school.
15,000 students.
It was by and large the largest charter school in this state. And I think that was another one of the challenges. I think you've seen some success in charter schools, especially these kind of smaller, better regulated ones that are perhaps performing better than the surrounding schools. But there are a lot of charter schools that are performing less well than the traditional public schools that they draw students from. And so I think you see in other states where charter schools are a valid, like, successful option for students, and you see that less often in Ohio, and so perhaps modeling off some of those more successful states.
And you see a lot of the local public school districts, in fact, statewide, you see public school districts embracing the idea of charter schools, and they have their own charter schools. They have their own online school within their district, or their own schools that deal with, you know, whatever a charter school can provide. They provide it. So, you know, I think that's also, you know, through the years, that's also come about as an alternative.
Has it cast a pall over the charter school industry writ large in Ohio, Jackie Borchardt?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, probably unfairly as well, for the, you know, reasons that Joe and Jesse were saying, that there are, charter schools that are thriving, that are doing good work, that have kids in classrooms or even in front of keyboards. I mean, I think the ECOT issue is really this idea of how do you make sure that your money is actually, taxpayer money is actually paying for students to be educated, to learn. And we've seen now, it's been, what, three years since they, Department of Education, changed how they counted. So, I mean, that's probably the biggest lesson, is that state officials realize that, you know, we have to have a better way to document that this money is going to actually educate students. But those rule changes are affecting more than just ECOT. I mean, the other online schools are having to, you know, grapple with that issue as well, of being able to prove and document that they have students enrolled and active to the state. And so it's just ECOT was the biggest one, and so you've got the big, you know, just pure numbers. But, you know, the political thing comes in with ECOT, with the political contributions, and mm-hmm. that Bill Lager was a huge, you know, Republican donor for many years. And, you know, I would say the other thing that we'll probably see more on is greater oversight over how the different businesses involved in running a charter school, and how the relationships between those, and again, it's following the dollars and where do the dollars go. And in some situations, and this was true of Bill Lager's enterprise as well. You know, they pay the school gets the money and they pay a management company to run their school. And at that point, the money is not, you don't know where it goes. It's black box. That's the topic of the day, maybe. Yeah. And you don't know where it goes. Or, you know, they pay rent. This is another issue that's come up in the last couple of years. They pay rent for their school to some private company that is affiliated with, you know, someone else that runs a school or runs the management company. So you're paying now the taxpayer dollar. How much of that is going to the student? How much of that is going to pay rent for this building? And it's all going to this same or related group of companies. So I imagine we'll see more of that as well. But I don't know, as far as an election issue, I just don't know. I would love to see like some sort of polling statewide on this. I know maybe folks in Columbus are more attuned to it, but I just don't know how wide of a reach ECOT has. Like, if you talk to a voter up in Ashtabula County, for example, or, you know, down, you know, up in Toledo, I just wonder if they know what you mean if you mention mm-hmm. ECOT, and if they can, if that has any sort of, you know, tangible meaning for their election when they go into the polling place.
I've seen headlines that this could affect State Auditor Dave Yost in particular. Why, Joe Engels?
Well, he embraced ECOT. He actually spoke at some of the graduations. He gave them glowing reports and talked about, you know, what a wonderful thing ECOT is. Now, you know, he's distanced himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I think the thing is, Anne, the thing I'm hearing here We were talking about it in the last segment about health care. Now we're talking about education. Is there are some problems that the state has in general. One is accountability, knowing where state dollars are going and exactly what they're going for and how they're being used. The other is, you know, this whole idea of profit in something that is a basic need. I mean, healthcare, education, it's something that the state has always been involved in, provided, and it's something that certainly citizens expect. Mm-hmm. So when you introduce a profit margin in it, does a private business actually do it better? And I think we're going to see that debate for sure. I don't think we're going to see socialized medicine.
Not all charters, by the way, are profit. In fact, in some states, they're not allowed to be for-profit ventures. They have to be nonprofit. There are some excellent charter schools in Ohio, and not all of them, but most of them are nonprofit.
Right. They're nonprofit for the most part.
Yeah. So it's not the free enterprise doesn't necessarily equate to better.
Right.
At least when it comes to education, obviously when it comes to healthcare benefits.
I tend to agree with Jackie that this is might be a little more esoteric of an issue than like
as far as how
healthcare,
as far as voters
respond to it, as compared to healthcare, which is another thing you see Democrats bringing up a lot, either Medicaid expansion or pre-existing conditions and Obamacare, especially in federal races. I think you have to know what ECOT is. I think you have to know what charter schools are. You need to know that money goes through public schools into charter schools. You need to know that Republicans were involved. It takes an element of explaining. And I've seen some of the Democratic candidates wrap it up in a minute or two, but it can get a little in the weeds. And I also think, at least in the Cincinnati area, kind of anecdotally, there are a lot of parochial schools, there are a lot of private schools, there are a lot of Christian and faith-based schools. And so I think a lot of students maybe went to those as opposed to charter schools. Mm-hmm. You see a greater concentration in the Columbus area.
And I would say, too, as far as like a political scandal, yes, millions of dollars and thousands of kids, were failed by this, but no one's gone to jail. There's been no public official has kind of taken the fall, so to speak. So those are the kinds of things I think that would resonate stronger with voters if Bill Lager had gone to jail or someone involved had been at least in court. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's just
someone in handcuffs. Plays well. On that.
Yeah. I think Democrats like to compare it to CoinGate, but CoinGate, by the time that became, the scandal became a political campaign issue, you had people in handcuffs and it was pretty much it had happened and it had been over a year. People could learn about it. I think ECOT, we're still like we had this court decision last week. We're still kind of going through it.
I wanted to talk about two more things in the time remaining. One being that I noticed Sherrod Brown has started to go negative against Jim Renacci in the U.S. Senate race. Seen it on TV, pretty negative ads. What is it? I thought that was a double digit spread or a double digit lead for Sherrod Brown. What's going on?
I think things always tighten up as you get closer to the fall. So that might be one thing that you're looking at.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I think in both DeWine and Sherrod Brown's case, because they're the better known candidate, having the opportunity to define your candidate, your opposition, and say this is who they are before they have the time and the money to do it themselves, I think is something candidates are looking to do.
And Renacci has not been on the airwaves as much as Sherrod Brown has.
I agree, yeah.
I mean, I watch like 10 minutes of TV a day. I've seen Sherrod Brown ads. I've not seen Renacci ads.
It kind of reminds me back when Governor Kasich ran for his first term in office against Governor Strickland. Mm-hmm. Governor Strickland had that huge spread back in the May. And then all of a sudden there were those negative ads that came in against him over the summer before Labor Day. Mm-hmm. This has that same kind of feel to it
just
for me.
For safety's sake kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And then Attorney General Mike DeWine, obviously the Republican candidate for governor, has been working with the Bureau of Workers' Comp to provide grants to law enforcement for, I guess, bulletproof vests or protective vests and that kind of a thing. And that sort of backfired on him. The Fraternal Order of Police for Ohio said union members are dismayed that Mike DeWine is politicizing their safety. What do you know? Joe Ingles is shaking her head sardonically again.
Well, everything is politicized right now, isn't it? I mean, let's be real. But yeah, I mean,
apparently they were.
Well, I think they have a fair point on, you know, on this issue. The story broke back in June, I think the Associated Press, that BCI agents had filed a complaint that they were wearing expired vests and had been for some time. And so that was a couple months ago. And then this announcement of, you know, hey, we're going to make this grant money through the Bureau of Workers' Compensation available to local programs. Meanwhile, their agents at BCI still haven't gotten all their new vests. They're still going without. So, you know, the FOP further down in their statement said, you know, we appreciate any effort to try to, you know, update equipment for our officers. But it was kind of like a too little too late. And you still haven't fixed the problem in your own house. And also our local, you know, police across the state are already taking advantage of grant programs like this one, national ones that to update their equipment.
And not to undercut what is obviously a valid point from the FOP, but they have also endorsed Rich Cordray, the Democrat. And so I'm sure politics are involved all around.
Right. And it was actually, you know, they released a statement through the Cordray campaign, I think, is how one way that it was distributed.
Okay. It's, you know, end of summer. What are you guys looking for this week? Anything?
Gosh, I'm looking to catch up before we hit Labor Day and this train really starts going down the tracks on the governor's race.
You know, that's the thing. I mean, usually summer is a time for political reporters where you can clean your desk and do all those projects that you need
not
to do.
Not anymore. To me, it's been like 25 or 30 years since
it seems
it was
like there's
like
something
that,
every week that kind of blows up the week, which is uncommon. I think, you know, what I'll be looking for is the ballot board is meeting this week to come up with language for issue one, which is the neighborhood drug treatment and rehabilitation. I'm forgetting it's got a long title, but it aims to divert nonviolent low-level offenders from prison through a number of means and give them more more abilities to shorten their sentences by doing community work and following other rules. And the ballot board is going to decide what language what that question looks like. And that can carry a lot of weight. If a voter is unfamiliar with an issue and that may be the only thing they see about it is when they vote and it's on their ballot and what is it titled, you know, how is it summarized? That's kind of important. And I think that issue will start to be ramping up. Department of Rehabilitation and Correction Director Gary Moore actually last week seemed to support what issue one is trying to do. He didn't go as far to endorse it, but he encouraged a crowd at the City Club up in Cleveland to look at it carefully and that he agreed with some of the steps that they're trying to take because they are somewhat similar to some legislation that we have seen clear the State House in the last couple months.
And, of course, President Trump will be here at the end of the week, so we'll find out if he eats dinner and who he breaks bread with.
who DeWine sits next to.
Who he asks for the salt and the pepper.
Exactly.
And if Governor Kasich shows up.
All right. That's the week. My guests, Joe Ingles, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, and Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Thanks to you, and thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.